This is Jan Swift, and you're listening to Discover Lafayette, a podcast dedicated to the people and rich culture of Lafayette, the gateway to South Louisiana. We tape in the offices of Raider, a hands-on IT service provider that integrates all of your needs for advanced technical support, effective communication options, and cybersecurity. Raider's motto is, you just want it to work. We understand. Please visit RaiderSolutions.com for more information. I'd like to thank Iberia Bank, our premier sponsor. They support our community in so many ways, and their dynamic team is committed to serving the banking needs of clients in this region and throughout the southeastern United States. Iberia Bank offers the resources of a national bank with the personal touch of a community bank. Please visit IberiaBank.com for more information. The generosity of Lafayette General Health also makes this podcast possible, and we thank them for being a premier sponsor. As Acadiana's largest nonprofit regional health system, Lafayette General Health is committed to restoring, maintaining, and improving health in the communities it serves. For more information, visit LafayetteGeneral.com. Isabella Delahoussaye is our guest today. Isabella is a native of Crowley and has worked and traveled all over the world, first as an international finance lawyer at White & Case LLP, then as an investment banker at Lehman Brothers, and currently she is the co-owner of Material Culture in Philadelphia, a retail establishment and auction house. Isabella is also an endurance athlete, mountain climber, and certified yoga instructor. A non-smoker, Isabella was diagnosed in February 2018 with stage 4 non-small cell lung cancer. She is currently biking across the U.S., and we are speaking on Good Friday, April 10th, 2020. This is a rich and compelling story, so I'm going to stop talking and just welcome Isabella Delahoussaye to Discover Lafayette so she can speak for herself. Isabella, welcome to Discover Lafayette.
Thank you very much, and I actually feel very lucky to have grown up in such a warm, wonderful place, Southwest Louisiana.
Yeah, when I went through my phone, Isabella, I looked up Isabella Delahoussaye, and I had your mom's number. I have her cell phone in my phone. She was the Crowley's first female and Republican mayor. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Yeah, so you grew up in a family that probably had high expectations for you.
Yes. Yes and no. I mean, they high expectations, but accepting of all, so of everything. So that was, it's a nice combination.
Right. You want to talk about your education and, you know, how you grew up in Crowley and then ended up moving on from Louisiana?
Sure. So I grew up in Crowley, went to St. Michael's Elementary School, and then on to Sacred Heart in Grand Coteau. And from Sacred Heart, I went to Princeton, studied politics and European cultural studies, did a Rotary scholarship in France, thanks to the Rotary from Louisiana. That was a wonderful year. And then went to law school at Columbia in New York and practiced internationally for another 8 years before going to Lehman Brothers. Okay. I started with Lehman Brothers in Hong Kong and then made my way back to New York with Lehman Brothers.
I'm curious about that. What is international finance? What type of work were you doing?
Project finance, where you're financing large infrastructure projects, roads, bridges, power stations.
Mm-hmm. So you were given the legal guidance to make sure the deals Yes. were done right. And then did your interest flip? Like what happened for you to join Lehman Brothers?
Goodness, that's a tough
I was just really inspired by that because that's kind of a big switch.
It was a big switch. And one of the things, it was your attorney. It was difficult being an attorney, and I was also raising young children. I have 5 children. Mm-hmm. And as an attorney, you're sort of paid by the hour. And it was a tough, you know, when I switched to Lehman Brothers, I could, I was rewarded for what my value added, and it wasn't on an hourly basis. And that was a much more comfortable place for me to raise my children and be a contributor and have a good job, but not have to track all my hours.
Indeed, I know. It was always hard for me to keep track of every 15 minutes, you know.
Yes.
Phone call, this and that. And as lawyers, just like doctors, you have to be on the job pretty much individually to make money. But as an investment banker, I'm sure you had some flexibility to work at home and work.
I did.
Work 24/7, even if it was maybe at midnight when your kids were asleep.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I had much more flexibility, and that it was a wonderful place to work. I was with Lehman for 9 years. I loved it.
Right. Now, I know you're married to David Crane, and you live, if you would talk about where you live now with your family.
Sure. We live in Lawrenceville, New Jersey, which is right next to, 5 miles from Princeton, which is mm-hmm. where we both went to college. And we are based there, but our work has been international. His work was international as well. So we've lived abroad a good bit and traveled a lot.
Mm-hmm. Now I know he's in the energy business. Is that right?
Yes.
And I did, yes. Coley Franson did give me an aside that David was involved, I guess, with an energy business and really has an interest in seeing things move to solar and the light center locally. There was some connection that David Crane, your husband, had with the light center with some solar panels. If you can just maybe talk for a minute about his, what he's done, you know, just so people get an idea of your family.
Sure. David was started as a lawyer, and also we were both worked at White & Case, both worked at Lehman Brothers. He knew the industry from a legal perspective, the power industry from a generation perspective. And so when he switched out of law and banking and became CEO, first of International Power and then of Energy in the United States. And these were companies that were power generators and using a lot of coal-fired power mm-hmm. plants. And, you know, he saw and recognized what that was doing to the environment and made a big push to add solar and wind and more environmentally friendly energy to the realm of generation that mm-hmm. those companies were doing.
Yeah. And that's like an uphill climb, I guess, with the U.S.
Yes.
Yeah. Right.
One day.
Right. One day. And I think it's going to happen. You know, our current podcast out this week is with Mark Miller, who's a local independent producer. And I think with the way energy is going, I think there's going to be an increasing recognition that we need smart energy policies, you know, that can sustain those that are producing gas and oil, and also those that are producing alternative energy sources. I think it's going to be a different day as we move forward after this COVID-19 pandemic. So,
well, it's interesting for me, having lung cancer and never having been a smoker, mm-hmm. and they don't quite know why, you know, 65% of the people who will be diagnosed this year will be never smokers. You know, increasingly the people getting lung cancer have never smoked, and there's a lot of evidence that it's linked to environmental pollution.
Right.
And a lot of that is driven by fuels that,
right.
you know,
right.
So the more clean energy or carbon capturing we can do, the mm-hmm. better for all of us, I think.
And if I may share, Isabella, when Coley Franson texted me and told me you'd be in town over the, you know, Easter holiday, he mentioned that you're one of four siblings, and all of you, except for his wife, Elise, have experienced cancer. And one of the common things besides being siblings was that you all water skied in a lake or a river, I'm not sure what it was, that has been designated a Superfund site that has a lot of cleanup that was needed. And so if we can transition, I'm going to let you tell your story. I don't want to second guess what caused your cancer. I know you weren't a smoker, and you are an endurance athlete. And when I post the notes for this podcast, I'm going to share all the things you've done. Like, you're an Ironman. You've run marathons in all the 50 states. You're an athlete, and you were not the typical person that comes down with cancer.
Well, interestingly, I'm not the idea that people have mm-hmm. of the typical person that comes down with lung cancer, but increasingly, I am the face of lung cancer. It's actually young active women who've never smoked, mm-hmm. and they don't quite know what is driving that.
What happened when you were, like, what, how did you know you had cancer? What, you didn't have, like, long-term symptoms? Like, what happened to you to get tested, to realize you had cancer?
Sure. Well, one of the problems, the reason so many people die, so let me just give you a little bit of information about lung cancer. So it does kill more men and women in the United States and in the world than any other cancer. And one of the reason you have such a high death rate is that it's usually diagnosed at a very late stage, mm-hmm. because you don't have symptoms till a late stage, and there's no early screening unless you were a lifetime smoker and are over 65.
So right. And you were young and, yeah, healthy.
Yes.
And,
yeah. So it tends to be diagnosed in stage 3 or 4. And at that point, the way it spreads, it starts in your lung and it usually goes into your bones and your brain. That's the trend that lung cancer takes. And when it metastasizes, when I was diagnosed, it was already in my lungs, my adrenal gland, my bones, my spine, and I had 6 tumors in my brain. So it was pretty far advanced. And the only way I would have known that I, you know, the only reason I went to the doctor was because I had a very severe sort of level 10 pain, mm-hmm. in my sacrum, my back area. And it was, you know, doctors initially said, oh, that's a pulled muscle. That's, mm-hmm. you know, everyone sort
active.
Of had,
right.
Because I'm active,
right.
And, you know, oh, you know, you'd either hear, oh, it's, you have a pulled muscle because you're active, or you have a pulled muscle because you're sitting at a desk all day, mm-hmm. you know, but nobody, no doctor, nobody said, oh, you might have lung cancer. And one of the reasons, you know, I'm on this journey across the United States and advocating for more awareness around lung cancer is that it takes such a consistent pattern that really, when I said I had that kind of back pain, some doctor should have said, oh, we need to make sure you don't have lung cancer.
Right.
Because that is a real, you know, if you ask, you know, 100 people what their first sign of lung cancer was, you know, 90 are going to say it was pain in my back.
And we've had that. We've had friends for years, like since the 80s here in Acadiana, my husband and I, that they first had back pain.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just thought they were being wimps. And the next thing you know, they're dying of cancer that spread,
yes.
throughout their body.
Exactly. Some people do have a cough. I never had a cough. Mm-hmm. I never felt compromised. A few months before I was actually diagnosed, I was racing and winning my age group in marathons
and
Ironman. So it didn't compromise me physically until, because I sort of kept going through the pain.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end, I had no more lower, my sacrum was 100% eaten up by tumor. So at the end of the day, I was bedridden. And it went from sort of, okay, I was able to do a lot, but in pain, to I'm in bed and I'm dying and maybe I have 2 months to live. So
oh my God.
It was a pretty quick demise.
What doctor, like who was it that said maybe she has cancer? Like what
so
day
I
was it that you found out? Like who?
I went to the doctor. They finally did an MRI after a few other sort of tests that didn't show anything. And the MRI showed tumors in my spine.
Oh, God.
And immediately they said, okay, now we need a CT, we need a PET scan. And just interestingly, the way that progressed through insurance is that the CT is ordered, and the CT shows that you know, it showed enough to say, oh, you have stage 4. And then they need a PET scan to take it one step further and do biopsies, and the insurance said, oh, sorry, if you're stage 4, you're going to die anyway. We're not going to approve the PET scan.
Now look, Isabella, you're well off. You probably have good insurance, right?
Yes.
Were you just freaking out?
Yes. But it's really sad that when you find yourself in that situation, that you still have to keep fighting just to get the care you
right.
need, you know, and the diagnostics you need.
And two lawyers can do that. Like, you knew,
yeah.
I can fight this. But think of all the people that...
I know. I'm well aware.
And I know that you're a spokesperson for people internationally that don't have means.
Yes.
But at that point in time, you must have been just...
It was. It felt like everything was a struggle at that point, just to figure out. And one word of advice I have, and this was something I didn't realize, but with lung cancer especially, and with all cancers for the most part, the treatments are increasingly turning on the mutation structure of the cancer, the genetic reason you have the cancer, and that took extra testing. So we didn't, my doctor, thank goodness I had access to doctors who knew this and said, okay, you know, because I was sort of saying, well, can I start treatment? Like, give me something now. I need to stop this. And they said, we can't, we don't want to do that until we have all this testing done. And that's going to take a month. So I had to wait a month between knowing I had stage four and was not doing well before they got the results back from the testing and said, okay, we know what mutation you have, and now we can give you a targeted therapy treatment as opposed to a very tough chemo infusion.
Right.
And that made a lot of difference, because then I was able to go, I went into a trial with the pill treatment and also an infusion of Avastin. But it was not as hard a treatment as if I had just been given, you know, an old school chemotherapy cocktail.
So you were diagnosed in February 2018. So when did things start turning around for you once you got treatment?
Honestly, that when I started day one, within 24 hours, I felt a difference in my body. That's how fast it worked. And it took a few months before I could, you know, those first few months, because the drugs are working, but they're also making you very sick. There are lots of side effects. And so I was pretty much in bed for a few months before I was able to get up and start trying to walk again and move again, and try to rebuild the bone mass that I had lost from the cancer.
But in that same year, in 2018, you ended up running and participating in the Ironman.
Yes.
Competition. So how did you do that?
Right. So
I mean, how?
A lot.
Most people
never,
could never do that anyway, even if they had never been sick or under chemotherapy. But how did
there
you do that?
There are two parts to that, honestly. And one is the mental part. And then you have to first get your head in the right place. Mm-hmm. And so you deal with the diagnosis, which is overwhelming. And, you know, your first reaction to that is to think, wow, I've lost the life I knew and loved. I've lost this, I've lost that. And you're sort of overwhelmed with sadness, and you think about all that you can't do. And that's just a normal, like, that's just a reaction. No matter how much you try to tell yourself life is good, life is really not that great in that moment in your own head, you know. And so the first challenge is really getting out of that space and refocusing on what you have left, your friends, your family. You know, I'm still breathing, I'm still alive. And so that's a transition that has to happen before you can then sort of pick up and start, you know, setting new goals for yourself in this new life with cancer.
Right.
And obviously the drugs were working. They do not work on everybody. I was very, very lucky that they worked. They stopped the spread of the cancer. In some places, like in my spine, the tumors actually shrank, which was wonderful, which that enabled me to then begin to walk and try to, you know, help my body create more bone mass. The doctors told me initially, with the amount of bone mass I had lost, that it would take years, and that I was not likely to see that bone would be replaced again. And again, I was very lucky that I was able to, the bone regrew, which is, right. You know, and part of that is just old school. We know that walking and resistance, you know, strengthens your bones. And that's what I did. I started walking as much as I could every day and just kept walking. And I was walking with poles, you know, one in each hand. Right. And initially putting as much weight on my arms, you know, more weight on my arms than my legs, but just trying to get them to move again. And, you know, you keep at it and you get stronger and stronger. And I remember doing my first marathon when I was recovering, and I was determined. I still had 7 states in the 50 states to finish, and I really wanted to finish them. And I took my poles and signed up for a marathon that gave me all the time I needed. It was one of these no runner left behind, take as long as you want. And I got out there and it took about 10 hours.
So you weren't running, you were walking?
Oh, no.
One step at a time.
I was so not running, yeah. Mm-hmm. But it was wonderful. They were very supportive. It's a group called Mainly Marathons. And I finished that, and that was a wonderful step. So I didn't think at that point I would bike again, you know, and when you talk about doing an Ironman, it's swim, bike, run.
Right.
So, again, that took me a little bit longer because I was really afraid, not so much of biking because I was able to get on a bike indoors, but I was afraid of biking outdoors and
the balance.
Falling.
Yeah.
And breaking more bones. You know, I'm like, well, I can't be breaking the bones I've been trying to heal. So that took a lot of overcoming fear to get back on the bike and get back outside.
Right.
And it was really the Ironman Foundation, which is a wonderful, it's part of Ironman, but it's the group that gives back and to the communities in which the Ironman races are held. And their foundation sponsored me to participate in the Hawaii Ironman. Mm-hmm. And Ventum, which is a bike maker, gave me a bike. And that was like the start of me saying, okay, maybe I can do this.
I can do this.
You know?
I'm going to post that on our website. I've got the tape from your interview and some of the footage from 2018. And your family was there with you. And
that was a beautiful moment.
It was beautiful.
And yeah, I didn't know. There was no point in that event where I was confident that I was going to make it till the end. It was really,
but you looked so healthy. Oh my gosh!
One step at a time.
You looked so vibrant and just vibrant. I've just got to say that. And I saw the photo of you and, you know, Nadia, you and your parents, and everybody was there for you.
It was wonderful. Yeah. I tell you, there have been quite a lot of moments in the past 2 years. I mean, I tell people that the past 2 years have really been the best years of my life. You know, there's something about being so close to death and then realizing you're alive that makes that living every second of it so, so amazingly and powerful, just so real. You're really mindful of being alive.
Right.
You know, and that's something that, when we take it for granted, we don't sometimes appreciate how beautiful it is.
Right.
So there have been a lot of moments in the past 2 years that I just think, wow, if I did die tomorrow, life is good. It's okay. You know, I've lived. So that's a great feeling.
I'd like to pause for Discover Lafayette's Past, sponsored by Rally Marketing, a full-service digital marketing agency that can assist you with marketing automation, content development, and strategy on how to use social media to turn into a moneymaker for your business. Our friends at Rally Marketing are there to help you navigate the maze of all the latest ways to market online effectively. For more information, please visit rallymarketing.com. And now the moment. Are you familiar with the story of the Marquis de Lafayette, the man Lafayette is named after? The Marquis de Lafayette was a hero of the American Revolutionary War, having served under General George Washington in several crucial battles. He was only 19 years old when he came to the States, and he had no previous combat experience. After the war, he returned to France and entered the political realm, championing the ideals of liberty that America embodied. President James Monroe invited Lafayette to tour the U.S. to instill the spirit of 1776 in the next generation of Americans and to celebrate the nation's 50th anniversary. Lafayette visited all of the American states and was received with a hero's welcome, traveling more than 6,000 miles and accompanied by his son, George Washington de Lafayette, named after George Washington. When the Louisiana legislature divided St. Martin Parish in 1824, it created Lafayette Parish. The parish name Lafayette was chosen due to the enthusiasm of the Marquis de Lafayette's visit to the U.S. However, our city's name remained Vermilionville due to the fact that the name Lafayette had already been given to a suburb of New Orleans. Eventually, in 1884, Vermilionville became Lafayette and joined dozens of other cities, counties, schools, and public squares named in honor of the Marquis de Lafayette. And now back to our interview. So, Isabella, let's pick back up. You became sick. You overcame things that most people couldn't. And we're taping this during the COVID-19's pandemic, which has really shut down all of not only the U.S., but the world. And you're riding your bike across the country. And any other time, people probably would have told you this was crazy. But you have just talked about knowing that every day is a gift. I think what you've learned from this, and I'm only sharing this because you've shared it with me and I've seen it online, but every day is a gift. Every moment is a gift. What is it that you've taken away from not only having cancer, but surviving during this COVID-19 pandemic? What can you share with us?
So the life, well, there are two things with COVID. I mean, one, it's keeping your own, yourself safe and healthy, and then it's about other people too. In most, like in a cancer world, you don't think that way. Like you're thinking about your health and being alive and doing what you can to make the most of every day. The COVID world is different because your decisions impact other people as well. And that's been, you know, as we've continued to move forward in this time, you know, every day we've had to ask ourselves, is this the right thing to do for me? Is it the right thing to do? Or are we putting anybody else at risk? And, you know, that's why we sort of are taking it one day at a time, because at any point that we think we are putting someone else at risk or that it's not safe, we obviously don't continue to move forward, you know. What's been amazing about our journey across the United States is just how much wide open, beautiful, non-populated space there is.
How far have you ridden? Traveled. Like what's been going on? Like how far have you ridden?
We've ridden 2,000 miles. Is what it? How many miles it was to get to Crowley, Louisiana, and honestly, you know, between riding, biking on back roads, so we're not, you know, in populated areas, and then some of our trip, we've been camping. Other times, we've stayed in places that people offered, you know, sort of safe places along the way. And we've really managed to avoid coming into contact with people. You know, it was
social distancing. Yeah.
Absolutely. To the extreme. I mean, I don't know that people can really imagine until they are really, you know, biking or hiking. Mm-hmm. You almost have to be biking or hiking to see the places we've seen.
Now, Coley told me you can't go back home, though. Like Coley said that you have five children. Back, I don't know if they're all in New Jersey, but they may have been exposed to people that had corona. So you really can't go back to your home, right?
That's correct. They were exposed, two of my children at college. Mm-hmm. Before the school shut down, both Princeton and Columbia had cases, and the kids were exposed and sent home to quarantine themselves. And when we were deciding, when it became evident how serious this was, COVID was, it was not safe for me to go back to New Jersey. That was for sure. And when I spoke to my doctors, you know, they said you're best off just staying clear of people and continuing to bike. And that's
which sounds
what
crazy.
We've been doing.
Huh?
it is a little. And even last week when I spoke to we had a televisit of my doctor, my oncologist, mm-hmm. And I said, you know, because I was scheduled to go back to New York for treatment April 1st. And they
for chemotherapy,
you know, the advice was I no longer get an infusion. I was getting an infusion every month. Until November. I'm not getting the infusion anymore, but there are tests that they have to do before they give me the pills just to make sure that I'm strong enough, you know, to take them, my blood counts and all. And they have put off that protocol for the next 2 months, and they were able to mail me the drugs. You know, this would have been unheard of in any non-COVID-19 situation.
But it's working?
It is what they're doing now with cancer patients who are able to be treated with pills.
Are there many cancer patients out there riding across the country?
No. No, not so many people. Interestingly, we did, you know, the few people we saw on our way from San Diego to Crowley were on bikes, biking across the country. And there were probably eight people doing what we're doing. It was sort of funny because people take the same route, which is a route that takes you away from towns and cities and keeps you on back roads because it's just safer generally.
So how are you doing this? Is David following you in the car? Like, how are you actually physically riding your bike across the country?
First of all, shout out to my wonderful husband who has been unbelievable on this journey.
Uh-huh.
This has been, he's really been amazing. And he has been planning, taking care of the logistics, the route, you know, doing when we camp, he's got the camp set up for
me. Camping?
All I have to do is, we were camping before, you know, it just depends. Sometimes camping's the safest place when you're trying to stay away from people.
Hotels, yeah.
So he's been riding. So we have a vehicle following us, and that is two wonderful people, Adam and Amelia, Adam is a bike mechanic, and they are a couple, and she's been supporting. They both are good bikers. They're good. They know how to fix bikes, and she's actually studying to be a physical therapist. So
wow.
I have my own traveling PT.
Wow.
So it's just been wonderful. And there, we arranged, you know, when we were planning this trip, that they would follow us across the United States. And so it's been a little adventure for all of us.
Right.
Initially, we had people were meeting us along the way, and we were going to be biking with a much bigger group, and my children were going to be part of it, mm-hmm. and friends and people who wanted to be advocates for lung cancer. Mm-hmm. And with coronavirus, that, you know, we just said it's not safe. We need to
Right.
Make our group as small as possible right. so that it's easier to stay safe that way. So that was sad to sort of have to cancel those plans. But, you know, there'll be other times to bike with people. And I hope other times to do the awareness events that we had planned. We were going to be at the, is it Miles Perez Center in Lafayette? Mm-hmm. We were going to be there on Monday. And, you know, that's been canceled. I mean, we've had to cancel all of those cancer center visits. And I think what we'll do is finish the ride if we can, and then come back when it's safe and do, you know, make the connections we had hoped to make along the route.
I want to ask you, I know that you give speeches about mindfulness and living in the moment. Mm-hmm. And a quote that I pulled that you had shared is, it's not about managing your fears. It's about expanding your comfort zones. Never give up. Focus on what you have rather than what you have lost. Stay active. Keep moving. Set goals. It's not survival of the fittest, but survival of the most adaptable. Love freely and be grateful. And remember that failure is not defeat until you stop trying. Now, with the COVID-19 pandemic putting many people in fear, I think we can all learn from your journey, because we're living in fear in our homes without illness yet. Most of us. You have been facing the reality of your diagnosis, and you're moving forward one day at a time, one step at a time. Can you share some of the things you've spoken about, Isabella, when you speak with groups?
Sure. I mean, one of the things, and I started my mindfulness journey, you know, 10 years before I got my diagnosis, and I've come along way with it. I mean, it's a journey, it's a practice, and it's a daily practice. And I've had a wonderful teacher and mentor who's taken me along. And I would encourage anybody and everybody to, you know, to start practicing and embrace a mindfulness practice. For me, it started with a yoga and a physical awareness of my body, and and it's become a very spiritual journey. So that's the first step. And I've been trying to share a lot of the lessons I've learned through my blogs and my online site. But with fear, first of all, that quote, you know, it's about expanding your comfort zones. I actually took that from the movie Free Solo. Uh-huh. So I loved it. And it speaks in a positive way about dealing with what can be a negative emotion. And negative emotions, which I would characterize as frustration, anger, sadness, fear, you know, we experience them, but they don't always serve us, you know. And so it's sort of being mindful of when we're experiencing them and asking ourselves, you know, is this helping me right now? Does it help me to be fearful and or angry or frustrated? And the answer is usually no. Mm-hmm. And once you can sort of take yourself through that process and say, okay, I'm going to put that behind me and replace it with joy and hope and the breath, which is centers us in the moment. You know, we're alive in this moment. And it just helps you deal with anxiety and stress, and is a very powerful tool. But fear, especially these days, I mean, I think it serves a purpose in that we want to be mindful of not putting ourselves and others in harm's way. You know, that can be a purpose of fear. But we don't want to dwell in that space. We want to then, you know, enjoy, if it's within the confines of your home, you know, find joy in that space and things you can do, whether it's, you know, FaceTiming family members or friends, whether or not it's reading books, doing puzzles, you know, working from home, you know, it's sort of focusing on the things you can do in that space, in that new place in your life, and making the most of it, rather than sort of thinking about, well, I wish I were doing this, I wish I were doing that. You know, they say the key to happiness is being happy with what you have, right. Not focusing on wanting what you don't have.
So you were focusing on this before any of the, before your diagnosis and also before the COVID-19 pandemic took over.
I was, you know, what led me to a mindfulness practice was having 5 teenagers and trying to.
I think we can all relate to that. Well, maybe not yes. 5 teenagers, but having teenagers. Yeah.
Yes, it was tough. And a lot of it, you know, teenagers, when they, sometimes they can say things they really don't mean, you know, and they'll say, oh, mom.
All of us can do that.
Mom, you know, yeah. Yes. And it's, you know, you can't control what someone else does, but you can control your reaction to it. And I had to learn to hear some of those nasty things they might say as mom, I love you. Mom, I'm mm-hmm. just afraid. You know, mom, I'm insecure. As opposed to, you know, and it's almost like hearing one thing and converting it into a language of love, which is really what they're trying to speak. They're just teenagers.
Right.
So that was my first sort of, experience with mindfulness, was learning not to get upset at that, at getting frustrated with them. I mean, they're doing the best they can.
And I know they're all so supportive of you in your journey.
Absolutely. They were just being teenagers. They were doing what teenagers do. And so you take the lessons there and you play it forward and in life. And, you know, I posted yesterday an exercise in sort of letting things go. And the mindfulness practice really teaches you to let go of any negativity right there in the moment, so that you don't spend, you know, every second of life is precious. And who wants to spend even a second of your life angry or upset, you know? Life's too short. Truly, it is too short.
Where do you post? Like, where can we go to find out more about you, Isabella Delahousie?
So,
I know you don't like social media, but you must
use it. I
know, I'm
not that adept with it. I have a young person sort of managing that for me.
Well, where do we go?
So I have a website. It's www.bikebreathebelieve.org.
Bikebreathebelieve.org. Okay.
And on that site, there's a blog section, and we are posting mindfulness exercises every day and ride updates. And it's in the ride updates that I am blogging every day and trying to share, share lessons I'm learning along the way. I will, getting back to the comfort zone question and fear, that is actually going to be the blog today, sort of the idea that whose comfort zone are you living in? Because a lot of times people have trouble separating out their parents' comfort zones, their friends' comfort zones from their own. And again, it's just being mindful of what your tolerance is, which is different from what other people's tolerances
are. And, you know, once you figure out, like I told you before we started, I was never comfortable with trying to tape this podcast myself because I wanted to listen to my guest without having to also watch, you know, like the equipment, how the sound was. And now that I've had to do this from my home study, I realize that the most important thing for me is just sharing the message. And if it comes out good, yeah, that's great. But I'm following my, it's so petty, I think, compared to yours, but I'm following my wish about sharing people's stories. And
yes.
I think you're sharing your story in such a bigger way. I'm just so grateful to be able to have you on this podcast.
We're all sharing important stories. Trust me. One thing that I I live by, and it was so helpful. I read years ago a book called The Four Agreements.
Oh my gosh.
Which is a very
powerful,
wonderful book. Yeah. And one of the lessons in it is that you can only, the only thing you can do is your best. That's
right.
It. And that changes day to day and under the circumstances. So there's no absolute best. You just do the best you can under the circumstances in which you find yourself and be happy
right.
with it. And that's, you know, if we all, it's such a, it takes away all this pressure when you think that way. You know, you don't have to be perfect. There's no perfect. It's just doing the best you can.
When you look back on your life, I just want to close with this. Can you share what's the most important thing when you look back on life? Like what really defines your life? Have you thought about that? Like what you're proud of, like what your life meant and what it means. I mean, it's still going on, but what's important to you in life?
I can answer that for myself, and there's actually a very real answer because I thought a lot about that as a child. And I will just tell you that as a child growing up in a very Catholic community at St. Michael's and at Sacred Heart, I wanted to be a saint.
Oh, gosh. Well, go.
I had big dreams, you know.
Saint Isabella.
And, you know, I wanted, I really, you know,
the five goals
I wanted to be
were
the
important.
Virgin Mary.
Yeah.
I wanted to be just, and I realized actually, I can even remember where I'm actually in the very house in the room where I thought about this. And I decided, wow, that's just too much pressure. Like I can't, I don't know how to do that. And I said, but you know what? I can do one good thing a day. I said, and in that point in my life, I thought, you know what? Maybe I'll deliver my neighbor's groceries for her. Mm-hmm. Like it was simple things, just simple. And I thought if every day I can make one person happy, then you know what? My life is going to be worth living. And I remember I was like 10 years old. I mean, this was like a very a young child trying to figure out, you know, what they can, what their tolerance is. It was just too much pressure to try to be a saint.
Mother Teresa said the same thing. She said, you know, just take care of your backyard, your neighbor. Like you can't change the world, but you can take care of your family and your neighbors.
Yep.
And you got that as a young girl.
Yeah. If you can make someone else smile, if you can, you know, it can be simple, you know, simple. So that's, that was a decision I made, you know, a long time ago. And I have tried to live by that and tried to instill that in my children.
Right.
And you know, there are other, that's what it comes down to. That's the most important thing.
I realized as you said that I had meant to ask you about, material culture. And I know that you're working now to make the world better for people around the world. And when I looked up your site, I came upon a picture of you and, President Bill Clinton sharing a peace rug, and you really work to enrich the lives of people that don't have much, they don't have many resources.
I will tell you, because there are a few thoughts there, and it ties back also to Louisiana. But Louisiana and Southwest Louisiana has such a distinct culture. And it's a beautiful culture. And I think in the United States, it's one of the few that has remained intact and as a unique culture. And I have been fascinated with people and culture and the way they express that culture my entire life, but rooted in recognizing that about Louisiana. And when I went to Princeton, I studied European cultural studies as a minor, and then went on and sort of got caught up in, I became a lawyer and then a banker. And I came, you know, after 20 years of doing things that were meaningful, but didn't really feed my soul. I came back and started working with cultural studies, again, as part of material culture. And what we do as a business, it's retail, it's auction, but we try to work with people producing by hand products around the world, mm-hmm. and support those efforts. And, it's a lot of it's supporting art projects, a lot of it, but art that reflects the culture from where it's which it's coming. So those peace rugs actually were made in Afghanistan, and we were approached by the U.S. the defense Office of Defense when the U.S. was pulling out of Afghanistan. They wanted to do social enterprise work, and we had the expertise. We were making carpets then in Turkey and in India. And they asked us if we would work with the women in Afghanistan and make what was popular then, where they were known as war carpets, war rugs. And they were collectible, and they had images of war and artillery. And if you can search Afghan war rugs, and you'll find, there are a gazillion stories about them. And we said that we would absolutely do the project, but we would only work with images of peace. And so we asked, we worked with different female women's cooperatives in Afghanistan and asked the women to not work with any set imagery, but just to weave into the carpet what they imagined peace looked like to them.
Oh my gosh.
And so each carpet was unique and beautiful, mm-hmm. and it was just a very powerful project for all of us to do. So that was the peace rug project.
What does peace look like?
In most of the mm-hmm. Images, it looked like family. It looked like nature. Lots of images of beautiful trees and flowers and animals and people, and in some cases school buildings. Mm-hmm. A lot of the women wove images of what teaching would look like, mm-hmm. and it was just beautiful. A really lovely.
It takes out all the pictures of government, war, strife.
It just took you right back to
your childhood.
The basics. Yes.
Yeah. Right. Isabella Delahousie, you've taken me back to what's important. As I sit here on Easter Friday, my family is so lucky, and I hope yours is too. We have a roof over our heads, and we're not at war, except with this COVID-19 environment. And I know that you're at war somewhat with your prognosis, stage 4 lung cancer, but I want to give you prayers for continued health, to keep on with your trek across the country and sharing your message. And I want to thank you and your family for being a part of my life. I'm very grateful to being able to share your story on Discover Lafayette. And did we cover everything you wanted to cover?
The one thing I would just add, when you talk about the war, because part of the messaging about my own cancer and the way I think, like sort of the mindfulness teaches you, is to be very conscious of the words you use and what words create sort of negative, stressful imagery, and which words you can replace them with that sort of can say the same thing.
And war is kind of negative.
Without,
huh?
Yeah, and I've been really trying to, I tell people I'm not, I'm just trying to coexist with my cancer. I don't need to kill it. I just need to, we need to follow the rules. It can't progress. It lets me live my life. I'm not trying to kill it off. We just need to live together. And I think that, with COVID-19, it's really about managing, it's learning, to live safely and with health, I mean, there's so many positive lessons that can come out of this, whether it's simple as hand washing and hygiene to being more, conscious about our underlying health conditions, weight, blood pressure, you know, things we might be able to do to help ourselves just be healthier so that when, you know, things like this happen, you're healthier going into it, which usually leads to a better outcome on the other side.
Right. And I know that has for you. I know that being an athlete and in good health has really prepared you to coexist with anything that came your way. So thank you, Isabella Delahousie, for sharing your message today. And I'd also like to thank Jason Sikora of Raider for mixing this podcast tape, as well as Raider, Iberia Bank, and Lafayette General Health for their support. Their generous contributions enable our podcast to be produced and distributed, and we're grateful. And we're also grateful for our premier partnership with Raleigh Marketing. Please subscribe to Discover Lafayette by going to your podcast app on your phone. You can also find all of our podcasts at discoverlafayette.net. Thank you for listening, and stay safe.